Notre Dame is headed to the national championship game, but how, again, did they beat Penn State? Plus, a Penn State vibe check as we look ahead to one half of the national championship game here on the College Football Power Hour. Welcome into the College Football Power Hour. He's Adam Brenneman. That's Jason Fitz. I am Caroline Fenton. And half of the national championship game is set on a Friday morning. Notre Dame takes down Penn State in the Orange Bowl 27-24. The first thing I said when that game went final, when the 41-yard field goal was good and Penn State couldn't get anything going with what the 8 seconds that they had left to make something happen, I said, how did Notre Dame win that football game? After a first half that they got absolutely worked on both lines of scrimmage, after a first half where they got outrun 141-15, when they lost their left tackle, when they already lost their starting left tackle in camp, they're down a right guard, and Riley Leonard was in concussion protocol, and Steve Angeli, their backup quarterback, had to come in for the last few minutes of the first half. When Riley Leonard threw two interceptions and Penn State turned that into 10 points, how in the world did Notre Dame win that football game? But that's just kind of been the story of Notre Dame all season long. They always seem to find a way. But Adam, we started our Orange Bowl preview pod with the ABVC, the Adam Brenneman vibe check. You're leaving Miami probably a lot sadder than you wanted to be. ABVC on Friday morning after your beloved Nittany Lions fall in the Orange Bowl.
Well, I'm calling in from the airport, so you may hear some like loudspeaker noises because right now an announcement's getting made. It was a late night in Miami. Game ended around midnight, so just recapping the whole thing and looking at the box score.
It
certainly would have been later if Penn State would have won that game. But listen, I think a few things. One is that the number that jumps off the stat sheet is Penn State rushes for 204 yards, 3 rushing touchdowns. You tell me that going into this game, and I'm taking out a mortgage on Penn State to win. I put everything I've ever seen on Penn State to win that game. Until you show me that Drew Aller went 12-23 with 100 yards, no touchdowns, and interceptions. So I think Drew Aller's lack of ability to finish that game and just not make mistakes and lose it is what lost Penn State the game in the second half. I think really the glaring error in this game is Penn State not going to overtime when they got the ball back with a tie game with 38 seconds left. The way Penn State was running the football, to not go to OT and try to win there is absurd to me. You get the ball, your own 25. If you're Penn State, in that situation, Penn State gets the ball at their own 25. There's 38 seconds left. And their wide receivers cannot get open. And you're attacking a Notre Dame secondary. That's the strength of their team. And you put your quarterback in a really tough situation where he's trying to make a play and go win a game without receivers that can win one-on-one. And what Penn State should have done is take that game to overtime, restart the game, and that's where Penn State can run the football. They can use their 12 personnel. They can go play action. They can put their 2 or 3 tight ends in the game. PSU is set up to win in overtime like that, the way they're handling the line of scrimmage. And I think that the fact that they tried to win that game there and tried to score with 30-some seconds left is, Drew Aller made a mistake you can't make. You can't throw late across the middle. It can never happen, but I think they put him in a bad spot. And ultimately, he doesn't have receivers that are good enough, which is a whole other conversation, to win in that situation. So I think that was kind of a hindsight 2020 thing to look back on. But even in the moment, I was thinking to myself, I don't like Penn State trying to score here, because you make one mistake, they're in field goal range, and that's what happened. Notre Dame picked it off and kicked the field goal to win the game.
Yeah, it's a smart point by you, Adam, because it also, think about just flipping the field. If you just wait to go to overtime, you flip the field, you get the ball at the 25-yard line going in. So now all of a sudden, all you have to do is run, and there was no gas left in a depleted defensive line for Notre Dame anyway, right? Like Notre Dame's defensive line was getting gouged. But Caroline, you started this by asking, how did they win? I think, this year's Notre Dame team is a lot less Rudy and a lot more Rocky. Like they're in the ring getting their butts kicked, but you can't get them down. And that's the part of this that is stuck in my head is, Herculean individual efforts. Like that Jeremiah Love touchdown run where somehow he manages to keep his balance and then he wills himself through four people that are trying to drag him out of the end zone. That's Rocky. That's what this Notre Dame team was. So
what are the best 2 yard runs of all time?
No, 100%. One of the best touchdowns. I mean, I sat there before because it took ESPN forever to give me a replay on it. I kept just rewinding it, looking. I'm like, how the hell did he do that? That is sort of the, to me, that summarizes everything that made Notre Dame great in this game. It's because Riley Leonard certainly didn't have a great, had a couple of just regrettable interceptions in this game. He didn't play well enough at times for them. And it kept looking at it saying, man, how is Notre Dame still in this? And then in the second half, you just saw that Rocky element of them. It's like, hey, you can keep punching me. Fine. I'll take all your punches, but you're going to have to take mine too. And that's where Notre Dame separates themselves. So I agree with you, Adam. They shouldn't have been aggressive there because there was nothing left in the tank for Notre Dame to try and slow them down.
Yeah, and Caroline, you asked how Notre Dame won that game. Fitz, I'll disagree with you a little bit. I mean, Riley Leonard made some mistakes, but they won because of Riley Leonard. I mean, he is a true competitor. And we talked on this show on the preview about Riley Leonard needed 15 to 20 rushing attempts to win this game, and he had 18. Most of those were designed quarterback runs on third and fourth down and short, where he was lowering his shoulder and playing like a fullback more than a quarterback. And then there were even times, I mean, he had some huge throws in that game. The wheel route up the sideline he threw, I forget, I think it was probably to Great House for a big play on a third down or fourth down. A ton of big situations that Riley Leonard showed toughness. And that's how you win in college football. You have a quarterback that can be tough and be gritty and wear yourself to win. He had two costly interceptions, for sure. That could have cost Notre Dame the game. But the way he ran the football is the formula for how Notre Dame wins the game.
And I'm not – you're right. He played very well in some of those spots. The turnovers, to me, were concerning. And then sometimes, like, we've all been working long enough together. Like, I live by the phrase, it's better to be lucky than good, right? Like, I believe it's better to be lucky than good. There was some luck involved. Like, that Great House touchdown, you had two defenders slip on the same play. Like, I just, there's a moment where that's why it felt like a Disney movie. Because it just felt like, you're right, Riley Leonard certainly, but I think I don't have the stat sheet in front of me, but I think his longest rush of the game was like 5 or 6 yards. So, it's not like Riley Leonard went off in the way that I thought maybe Riley would have to go off. And they survived a couple of just Herculean, like amazing interceptions, amazing individual plays on both sides of the ball. I think we need to just take a second and acknowledge that this was an instant classic because so many individual players played out of their minds in this game. Like I want to at least caution trying to find somebody to blame for the loss when I think this is the sort of win that you spend more time crediting for the win. So I will say that Riley certainly played well enough to win at times. I just, to your point, Adam, if we'd said going in that there'd be two costly interceptions by Riley Leonard and that, you know, while he ran the ball, he didn't necessarily have a huge, oh my God, run. I would have bet the house that meant Notre Dame lost, and instead Notre Dame won that game.
And you can call it luck or bailouts. There were bailouts on both sides. Like Riley Leonard got bailed out big time when Nick Singleton dropped a football right at the goal line that would have been an easy touchdown. He drops that football. Penn State kicks a field goal instead of scoring a touchdown. That was a 4-point mistake from Nick Singleton and a huge bailout for Riley Leonard. But Drew Aller got bailed out a couple times too. The holding call on one interception and then the controversial pass interference call that frankly I didn't agree with. That's a story for a different day. But the pass interference when he was intercepted in the end zone, when Tyler Warren was kind of falling down, that wasn't PI. That was just an underthrown football into double coverage and was a horrific mistake from Drew Aller that he shouldn't have made, but he got bailed out. But I think ultimately, weirdly enough, it felt like the momentum shift for Notre Dame came at a point when I thought Notre Dame was going to get completely buried. And it was when the left tackle was out, the right guard was out, and when Riley Leonard was out, and Steve Angeli gets sacked and fumbles on first down. And then Notre Dame comes up with a football. I don't know what kind of Houdini kind of magic work happened in that dog pile. Walked away. I turned away from the TV because I thought that Penn State recovered the football. It looked like they had recovered the football. I don't know if someone just gouged his eyes out the dog pile and snatched the ball from him. Like, that's what it felt like. But Notre Dame being able to recover that fumble, kick a field goal before half, get that momentum going into halftime, getting the ball first in the second half, and then that touchdown drive and that massive, what is it, 36-yard reception to Anais Williams. It went on, I think it was like a first down midway through that drive. Like, that was where the momentum shift came. And so I think that's kind of the microcosm for Notre Dame this season. So many times I counted them out after that Northern Illinois loss. I counted them out. When Riley Leonard went down, frankly, I counted them out. When they came into that game with as many injuries as they had, Riley Mills, their leading sacker, Benjamin Morrison, one of their best DBs, if not one of the best DBs in the country. And like I mentioned earlier in the show, losing your starting left tackle in camp. So many times we could have counted Notre Dame out. So many times we did count Notre Dame out. And so many times in that game, and really throughout the majority of the season, but specifically in this game last night against Penn State, when Notre Dame could have just tucked their tail between their legs and just given up, they didn't. But to me, that turning point was the not losing that fumble and being able to turn that into 3 points. That was like, you know, that was like Superman putting on the cape at the end of that game. Shout out to Stephen Jelly, by the way.
And Abdul Carter jumped on that football and then somehow didn't come away with it. I mean, it was, I couldn't believe it. That probably would have been the end of the game. Penn State would have won if they recover that fumble. You know, I thought the interesting thing from the scheme standpoint was just that Penn State was really prepared for Riley Leonard. And then when you saw when Steve Angeli went in there, Penn State struggled with that quick passing game. He was able to get the ball out quickly. And I think that really comes down to, against Riley Leonard, Penn State was playing with a spy at linebacker, playing off coverage a little bit and keeping everything in front of them, making sure they didn't go with the big shot, and then just trying to spy the quarterback and play against the run. And then Steve Angeli comes in. It's so different than what Riley Leonard does. He does the quick passing game, and they were able to really dink and dunk their way down the field there for, you know, a series or two. I forget how many drives he really played in, but I thought that was a big drive there to end the first half for Notre Dame. So I thought that was interesting, you know, where the backup comes in, but Notre Dame's offense looked almost better at that point for a couple of plays.
Yeah, and by the way, Marcus Freeman and Notre Dame have already made it clear they're not going back into the transfer portal next year at the quarterback position, which I think is sort of an interesting thing to come out and tell the world. And then you watch Angeli come onto the field and just, man, I mean, he throws a pretty football. Like, I just sat there watching that man, like, not only control, but just, it looked pretty. Ball placement was great. I looked at it, I was like, this kid's just, he looked calm as could be for it. Like, I think that sort of epitomizes everything about Notre Dame. Like, we always talk about next man up, and that's a great principle unless your next man up looks like me, right? Like, we can say next man up, but like the next guy come up might just get his ass kicked. I thought it was really impressive that next man up didn't, I mean, they mentioned one of the offensive linemen that came in that had only played 60 snaps all year, didn't see a big drop off. Like, next man up was a big part of how Notre Dame won this football game. And I still can't believe it went down that way in that sense. Like, so many things, if we just made a pros and cons list of how this game went down, so many of these games, things went to the way that we would thought would have meant a Notre Dame loss.
Yeah. My kind of one more point I want to make about this game. I've seen so much talk about Drew Aller and how bad Drew Aller played in this game. And listen, although the numbers for Drew Aller were brutal, and obviously the interception to give Notre Dame the win is inexcusable, but I can't put this game all on Drew Aller. The only true error that Drew Aller really made in this game was throwing the ball late across the middle, across his body, setting up that Notre Dame field goal. Critical error by your quarterback. But other than that, Penn State just couldn't find that big play in the passing game. And a lot of that is because of, I'll put more blame on Eddie Kotelnicki, their offensive coordinator, and their wide receiver room. This is a far deeper issue for Penn State offensively than it is on their quarterback. You know, Penn State did not have one wide receiver catch a pass in this game. Not one wide out called a pass. All tight ends and running backs. Zero separation all night. Absolutely got swallowed up by the Notre Dame secondary. When you look at a third down play and you have Penn State's wide receivers out wide, there's not one of them that you look at and are like, oh, this guy's a threat. This guy may get open right now. I mean, it's quite frankly inexcusable for Penn State. And I think James Franklin would say the same thing. Notre Dame also, on top of that, has similar, if not worse, talent at wide receiver than Penn State has. And you get a guy like Jaden Greathouse who goes for 105 yards and the big play that was there that Penn State just couldn't find. You know, if I told you coming into this game that Penn State said everyone would have to carry them. Now, I didn't think it would mean no wide receivers would catch a pass for Penn State. So to put it very bluntly, Penn State's lack of ability to recruit elite wide receivers is a failure from the top down. And it is a disservice to their five-star quarterback because you can. It's hard to win games and hard to win championships when you don't have any separation. And on that interception that Drew Aller threw that lost the game, you watched those routes, and not one receiver had even an inch of separation anywhere. And it puts him in a really bad spot. Again, inexcusable. Take the game to overtime and go win it. But it puts your young quarterback in a bad situation. And Penn State's got to figure out. And it's not like Penn State hasn't had a good history with wide receivers. You think about KJ Hamler and Kondre Lambert-Smith and Jayshon Hamilton and Chris Godwin, so many great players. Really, the issue is Penn State losing Kondre Lambert-Smith in the transfer portal, who ends up having a great year at Auburn. They bring in Julian Fleming, who nowhere to be found, doesn't have a single target in the biggest game of the season for Penn State. Really, I think it comes down to a systemic issue for Penn State at the wide receiver and passing game position, more so than it is just on Drew Aller.
It's hard to win national championships, win college football playoff games, when not a single receiver has a single catch. And that was Penn State in the Orange Bowl. Not a single receiver had a catch. And you bring up Notre Dame's wide receiver room, and it's true. It's not like Notre Dame has, you know, future, you know, Super Bowl MVP wide receivers on their roster, but Jaden Greathouse would be Penn State's top receiver. Jordan Faison would be Penn State's top receiver if they were on Penn State's roster. So, yes, it's a deficiency on both sides, but I think when you look at the blame pie, because I don't like to place blame on one person. It's a blame pie. Part of it goes to Drew Aller for making that decision. Part of it goes to, you know, Nick Singleton dropping that touchdown. If he catches that football and he marches into the end zone, Penn State probably wins that football game. And I do think a big part of it, not just on this game, but on this season as a whole, has to go on the coaching staff, on why can't you recruit more talent to Penn State at that specific position? Because as much blame as Drew Aller is going to get for making that decision that he did at the end of the game, what did we say about Drew Aller last season? Like, what was the number one critique of Drew Aller and this Penn State offense? You have to push the ball downfield. You have to take a few more risks. Even if it comes up with an interception, at least you're moving the ball. At least you're taking some risks. And then you're seeing the other side of that. And ultimately, that comes back to bite you in the butt. When you have deficiencies like that, games like this and teams like Notre Dame are going to be able to expose that. But, you know, on the broadcast last night, post-game at the end of the broadcast, they were talking about, you know, well, Penn State fans should feel really happy and really excited about what this season was, about getting to the college football playoff semifinal, getting to the Final Four, not something they were able to do in the last iteration of the college football playoff. I always have an issue with broadcasters telling fan bases about how they should feel. Like, don't tell me that I should feel excited about my team not getting to the national championship game. But how do you feel, Adam? Like, what do you think is the feeling, overarching feeling of this Penn State fan base waking up on Friday morning?
I think the feeling overall for Penn State fans is deep frustration, but also I think some gratitude and appreciation for the kind of season it was. I think for the most part, Penn State outperformed their level of talent on their roster. And you can make the case that they got a slightly easier path in the playoff, and some things went well, some things didn't go well. But I think there's appreciation, and you know, I was there obviously, and was watching as the players left the field. And normally, when Penn State loses big games, it is not a pretty scene when Jace Franklin leaves the field. But it was cool to see, like, the Penn State section was like standing ovation, like cheering along Coach Franklin as he left the field. And as you guys know, he normally is getting booed when he loses those types of games. So I think everyone's appreciative of it. The frustrating part, and just the disappointing part, is that Penn State had 10-point leads against Ohio State and Notre Dame and lost both those games. Had chances to win and had chances to have an undefeated season, and obviously lost to Oregon in the Big Ten Championship as well, but that was a close game. So there were a lot of opportunities that I feel like were missed. But, you know, 27-24 loss to Notre Dame in Penn State's first ever semifinal appearance. Not a failure for James Franklin at Penn State. Definitely a huge disappointment in a big moment. But the game was an instant classic. It's everything we thought it was going to be. And I thought it was a really, really cool moment for Penn State.
I think, Caroline, too, let me just say, like, you're right. It's dumb for anybody to tell any fan base how they feel. That's fine. I think what happens sometimes, that the reason announcers do that, or people like me do that, is because we're not as close to any of it. So when you take the closeness away, I will remind it, like my fandom for the Raiders is something everybody knows, right? And when the Raiders lost the Super Bowl, I remember it had been so many years in a row they'd lost tragically in weird games that I looked at one of my buddies and I said, you know what? I'd rather not even make the playoffs than watch another playoff loss. This is ridiculous. I said that out loud. Since then, I've seen two winning seasons and I've seen 13 seasons with double-digit losses. And that, like, when you put it in, I think part of the reason that there's constantly this, like, hey, Penn State fans, like, you got to the Final Four. And I get why Penn State fans are going to say that's not a respectable answer and that we're national championship or bust. And I get the 1-15 record for Franklin against the top five. I understand all of these things. But I also think you got to look at it and say, man, understand that you're in a moment right now. And if you don't appreciate these runs, if the only thing that's ever going to bring you any level of appreciation for college football is winning a national championship, you're going to spend the majority of your life as a fan miserable. And what's the point of spending the majority of your life as a fan miserable? Like, yeah, you might have a run where you win one or two, but if you can't appreciate a year where you get to the college football semifinal, like, then why, at some point, where do you ever find joy in this process? If the only thing that will bring you joy is a national championship, you're going to be disappointed constantly. So I think that's part of the reason people do it. I think that James Franklin's terrible record against top opponents is an important part of the context of the conversation around James Franklin. But I also think you can look at it and say two things are true. You know, this is a Penn State team that played lights out for a lot of the season. This Penn State team that made it to the Final Four. Enjoy part of this run.
I also think that two things can be true. That you can be frustrated, that you're always a bridesmaid and never a bride, that you're always good enough to, you know, be up there but not get there, or get there but not get to the big one. And that's where Penn State fans are, I'm sure, frustrated that they can't break through to get to a national championship or win a national championship. You can be frustrated that you are allowed, and that is understandable. But at the same time, you have to enjoy the ride. You have to enjoy the progress that's being made while also pointing out deficiencies of why you didn't get to the big one, why you didn't achieve your ultimate goal. And that is, I think, number 1A, priority in the offseason. Whenever you're bringing back a lot of talent, you're losing a lot of talent at that, is bringing in better receivers. Help out your quarterback. That's the most glaring thing for me for Penn State going into the offseason. And then on the other side for Notre Dame, how many years have we talked about that with Notre Dame? They got to the college football playoff twice, and they were favored, I believe, in both of those games and lost both of those games. I think it was Clemson one year and then Georgia the other. Like, that's frustrating. That's kind of been the story of Notre Dame, of getting there and not pushing through to the next one. And now here they find themselves in the national championship for the first time in over a decade.
We've been talking a lot about James Franklin at Penn State. I mean, the Marcus Freeman stock could not be hotter right now either. And I think there's my affiliation on this show. We focus a lot on Penn State in these segments, but I mean, he has their team competing. I love his swagger. And I heard on the broadcast, they mentioned that he's about to turn 40 years old. I'm like, I didn't even realize he was that young. I mean, it's just crazy how hot his stock is right now. And, you know, I thought it's cool. You could literally see it in his eyes on the sideline that it meant something to him to be the first African-American head coach to compete for a national title in college football history. So I think really cool to see him have that win. And you know, it is interesting. Him and James Franklin have some weird beef. I don't know what it is, but you can just tell, like, when they were out there at the press conference, it was, I saw they had the little embrace after the game where Franklin was talking to him. So I don't know what it is, but I just thought it was interesting. But it's cool that Marcus Freeman gets to enjoy that moment. So sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to give him some props there.
No, I'm glad you did, because Marcus, first of all, James Franklin and Marcus Freeman, two black head coaches competing for an opportunity to be the first black head coach in a national championship game, is something that should be stated and something that absolutely should be celebrated by us, by Marcus Freeman, by everyone in that Notre Dame locker room, and by everyone in that fan base. But there was some weird beef. I think it was like the press conference going into this game. James Franklin talked about Marcus Freeman's age, and I think maybe Marcus Freeman felt a little bit of... Like maybe James Franklin was undermining him a little bit, but yeah, there's been some awkward exchanges between those two head coaches. But we'll take a quick break here. Powerhouse power outage on the other side. Okay, power hour, powerhouse. I'm going to start us off with this one because we haven't talked about it yet and it deserves to be stated. Jeremiah Love Hurdles, power hour powerhouse. They even said on the broadcast going into that game that Jeremiah Love said, because his knee's banged up and it's been banged up since that regular season finale against USC. The broadcast said, Jeremiah Love said, Marcus Freeman, I promise, no hurdles tonight. I'm not going to be pushing it too far. And then he had the coolest hurdle of all time. I think it was like a sixth or seventh of the season that he's standing there and just jumps up like 6 or 7 feet. Like it defied all laws of physics that hurdle was more impressive to me than like the 36-yard pass that Riley Leonard followed it up with. So power hour powerhouse to Jeremiah Love doing that with an injury, just doing that. Period. It was awesome, Adam.
The very best hurdles are the ones where you don't even have to hurdle. And and on that, I mean, the one you're talking about, like I think it was Kobe King that Penn State was the one attempting to tackle, was standing straight up. Like it wasn't even like a hurdle. Yeah. Hurdle situation is still hurdling them. So really cool. I'm gonna go similar on the Notre Dame side, obviously. This one's especially for Fitz. Because I think it's time sing the praises of kickers instead of only bashing them when they miss. Notre Dame transfer kicker Mitch Jeter, 5 of 12 on the season coming into the playoff. A big name transfer from South Carolina. He's now 7-8 in the last three games, including 3-3 against Georgia and 2-2 against Penn State. So didn't have a great regular season, but has stepped up in the biggest moments and made the game-winning kick, obviously, to instead of sending the game to overtime. So I let's just give him some credit because I feel like we never talk about him unless they miss a bunch of kicks like we saw in the Texas-Arizona State game.
I'm telling you, Adam, I had this list. Jeter was my call for this. I was going to give kickers love. I've been so hard on him, and I'm gonna double down. Like, I'm going to admit, I got a little misty-eyed there at the end of the game when the TV broadcast went to his dad sitting there, because you just think about, like, the dad of the kicker, like the one person in the entire stadium that's actually wearing a kicker's uniform, and you just know what it means. And you're right. The broadcast mentioned several times groin injury, sort of had him. And Marcus Freeman was asked on the sideline after it, and it was like, never had a doubt. You know, all the things the coaches say. I just keep thinking about how much you know when you are walking up. And look, I'm tough on kickers, but when you are, I'm also lenient on kids. When you are a college kid walking up to make a kick, and you know that the entire narrative about your university is on the line and a chance for the national championship, to slow your heart rate down and do what you have to do in that situation, I can't imagine. I think 99% of the people watching that kick would never have the guts to be able to pull that kick off effectively. They'd never be able to control their adrenaline. He did it, and the way he turned around and just the fist pump afterwards, to me, that was one of the most memorable parts of that game. I loved every set. I became a kicker fan in that moment. So, yeah, let's give some kicker love to Jeter. Well done.
On the broadcast, there was a graphic that said, like, in the history of the college football playoff, kickers are 0-4 in potential game-winning kicks. I was like, why would you do that to the poor kid? Like, why would you just jinx him like that? And obviously, didn't matter. We're bucking the trend.
Broadcast needs to change that. Broadcast needs to start saying nothing. They should just tell you the name of the kicker. Be like, Mitch Jeter up to kick. We will tell you nothing until after the kick is attempted. And then afterwards, they can give us all the context. Just eliminate
golf clap and stir our tea until he makes it or not. Thank you very much. Power outage.
I'll be honest, you guys. Like, I don't really, I know this sounds soft. I don't really have a power outage. Like, I'm usually tough on so many people through the process of this game. I think Drew Aller could have played better. I think that's probably fair. But, man, I also don't think that Penn State is where they are without Drew Aller at times. So, like, I walked away from this saying I don't pin blame on anybody. And usually power outage for me is so easy to see. Well, this guy should have played better. This guy should have done. Like, we could spend an hour talking about even Abdul Carter's Herculean performance in this game. The Notre Dame offensive line that we went off about. Like, I think Warren had some big plays for Penn State. Like, go across the board. This game wasn't about who failed. It was about who succeeded. I don't really have a power outage that stands out to me, Adam.
Yeah. Also, side note, Tyler Warren is so unbelievable. It's just, we didn't even talk about it. Oh God, I mean, he's so ridiculous. It's just crazy. And like, it's just funny because like, he's not even that like freak of an athlete. Like, he's not even like moving that fast. So he just like somehow makes huge plays. But I mean, Penn State should have thrown the ball 15 times. My power
outage. He touched
the
ball, what, 8 times?
Yeah, I mean, not enough when your receivers don't have a single one. Yeah, that's a good one, yeah.
Give him the ball 50 times if you have to. Like, feed Tyler Warren the ball. Everyone in the stadium knows it's going to Tyler Warren, and he's still able to make plays. That's my power outage. Yeah. I apologize for interrupting. Yeah.
No, I think I was actually struggling to think of one at that point, so I like it. I mean, Tyler Warren should have had the ball 15 times. I mean, I didn't love the officiating in this game. I thought there were some just questionable big calls and then a lot of no calls on both sides, like not even one way or another. Probably all even out at the end, but there were a bunch of like holding calls on Abdul Carter that didn't get called. The PI call on Tyler Warren they bailed out the Drew Aller interception, I thought was a little flaky. You know, the biggest power outage, I'll go Penn State's vertical passing game. It's been that way all season long, and ultimately it came back to bite him in the biggest moment.
I do like your ref call real quick, by the way. I think they were inconsistent because in the beginning they let him play, and late in the game it felt like they weren't letting him play. And then, like, sometimes you got the missed holdings that was right there, the weird pass. Like, they couldn't decide if they were going to let him play or not let him play. That frustrates me. I don't ask for officials to be perfect. I just ask for officials to be consistent over the course of a 60-minute game. I didn't think they were particularly consistent.
I don't ever like to use refs in a blame pie. Sometimes they deserve to be there. And I wouldn't add it to my blame pie for last night for reasons why Notre Dame either won or Penn State lost that football game. But I do think it's fair to point out there were some inconsistent calls and some questionable calls that was made last night. Before we wrap up, one more power hour powerhouse for me, and that is the executives at ESPN. Because we are going to get a national championship game that's either Notre Dame, Texas, or Notre Dame, Ohio State. And that is ratings gold. That is two of the three biggest brands in America. Two or three of the biggest brands in all of college football. Some of the most passionate fan bases. Three of the most Walmart fan bases in America. So that ESPN is going to be raking in the dough of ratings, of viewership, advertising dollars, of just the sheer brands, you know, weight that two of those three brands are going to carry. So I think that's going to be huge. It's going to be like a Peter Millar, you know, warehouse in that stadium with, you know, Notre Dame, Texas, and Ohio State. It's just going to be like the most, like, my dad's a lawyer fan bases.
But you're right, though. Like, I'll go back to when I worked at ESPN. People always thought they still think there's a huge SEC bias. The one thing inside the halls, we used to always joke, at the time, Texas wasn't part of the SEC. And we always said, like, the perfect Final Four for ESPN was never SEC teams. It was an SEC team, Texas, Ohio State, and Notre Dame. Because those are the four that are going to get you ratings no matter what possibly happens. Now Texas is part of the SEC, so you get the win-win out of that. Caroline, you're 1,000% right. Like, Jimmy Patero, who runs ESPN, is just doing – like, he's laying in just a bed full of cash like Scrooge McDuck right now looking at the ratings that he's going to get for this thing. And congratulations, Jimmy. Enjoy the coins. You deserve it. Like, it's going to be a ratings just absolute – this thing's going to be wild.
In a college football playoff where we could have had a Boise State, Arizona State college football playoff final, no disrespect to those fan bases, we love them very much, doesn't carry the same kind of cachet that these three final teams will. But that's going to do it for us today. Safe travels home, Adam. We'll be back tomorrow morning with a full breakdown of the Cotton Bowl, assuming it does in fact happen, because I know that Dallas is having some weather, some ice and some snow, so everybody stay safe out there. But we'll be back with a full recap of Texas, Ohio State, when the national championship game will be set. So we'll be back tomorrow morning. Always appreciate y'all for stopping by the pod. Give us a like, give us a subscribe, give us a review, tell your friends, tell an enemy, tell James Franklin, because we love him here on the podcast, and I'm sure that he's going through it this morning. We'll see you Saturday morning after the Cotton Bowl. We are out.